With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. This is the Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. And I was just talking to James before the break, who was talking about some of the things that happened in the 20th century and the 21st and part of our outlook. But James, you also had said quite rightly, I think, that when people started pushing back around ULEZ and other things, we've seen that these weak authoritarians don't have a rudder themselves. They lack a bit of spine. They're not actually committed to a set of principles. And in fact, when we push back and we have a sort of clarity of purpose, we can have quite a big impact. I suppose I wanted to ask you, just, you know, as a historian, but also someone who's come together, you know, joined together and is on the cabinet, what you think the prospects are in terms of challenging things like this net zero outlook, and in terms of our productivity, creating wealth, being ambitious, all the things that seem to be unfashionable now about, you know, the public having a say, all those people that the third way said were, well, you know, not those people, don't let them know all these. Us, the demos, the people, having an impact in shaping the direction of things and putting pressure on those elected, and maybe even standing as well and becoming elected, but just having an influence on where we're going in Britain over the next couple of decades. And how do you see that, really?
Well, I remember in about 1998, Urban Task Force report came out, and a friend of mine, Ian Abley, was saying to me, can you believe this? And I couldn't quite understand what he was saying. And he said, can you not see that the meaning of this is we're not going to build any new houses, that the whole plan is we're going to constrict growth, the green belt's going to get bigger, in this name of saving the environment. And I said, they can't be serious, as I was reading through it. And we were looking at each other, and they were serious. They were actually, you know, had a plan. They called build up, not out. The whole thing was about limiting growth. And I thought, well, you know, it's obvious what's going to happen is that houses prices going to go out of control because demand will outstrip supply. And you'll have this kind of long-term crisis over housing because, you know, it's a bit like a ship, you know, takes a long time to turn it around. And I can remember we talked to every policymaker, we talked to David Miliband, and we were trying to say, if you do this, it's going to go tits up. And and they were perplexed, and they would say, but what about the environment or something like that? I'd say you're robbing your kids in the name of you know, some kind of vague goal. And the thing was that I mean, I can remember being angry and frustrated at lots of times, but I always knew that, well, the truth is this is an unworkable policy. It's not just that it doesn't meet people's needs. It itself is a disaster policy waiting to happen. And then slowly politicians used to start saying what we'd been saying to them. And they would say, you know, we need to fix this. And, you know, I think maybe it was that Grom, what's his face? Can't remember. The housing minister said they'd done more damage than the Luftwaffe to the housing. And I thought, well, yeah, I mean, I was trying to tell you that. And I feel the same about the net zero more broadly and the ULEZ. And a lot of these policies literally don't add up. You know, if you try and organize, I mean, an economy that has developed for 50 years, but half a century, more than half a century, on the presupposition that people move around and travel. And then you try and, like, stop that. You know, it's like somebody squeezing your artery and saying, you know, how you're feeling. And you think, well, you know what's going to happen. And you meet them all the time. You meet these people like Ed is up in Haringey, or Niall Crowley in Hackney. And they're, because they live on the side of a low traffic neighborhood. And so all the traffic is on their street. And this is just like happened to them overnight, and they're like spitting feathers, and everybody else is like scratching their head saying, oh, what, well, don't you want low traffic? Or don't you want an ultra low emission zone? And you're thinking, well, how did you not know this was going to go wrong? So I do think that, I mean, this is not good, but I do think we've got a lot of chances because the mismatch between not just, you know, what ought to happen, but, you know, what's just plain sensible and what they're trying to do is so great that you've got to take every opportunity to illustrate and show why these policies do not correspond to ordinary people's lives, you know. And if you set out to reduce the amount of houses or to reduce the amount of traffic or, you know, to stop generating energy, quite quickly, that's going to cause real hardship for people. So we need to be there, pointing it out, saying, this is your policy. This is what you did. And people find it hard to connect. But I think I feel very angry that these things are happening, but I feel very optimistic that it's not that hard to show why it's going wrong.
So I want you to try and do two quick answers to two questions. Then we're going to finish up on the Together Cabinet and what you're doing there. But people sometimes say to me when I say I want millions more housing, often quoting your book, the problem is it's just all migrants coming in and that's just all the... So that question, right, is it just like, do we need new houses and why and who's it for? And the second one is the Green Belt. A lot of people who say they're for productivity and wealth creation for many are also saying, but, you know, we got to protect these lovely sort of Green Belt and other areas. So what's the argument for going, as well as density, but expanding out towards the Green Belt? I mean, have we got loads of green land in Britain unused and all of that? And this question, do we really need all these new houses, or is it just because people keep letting too many people in? How do you see that?
I think when people express their anxiety about illegal immigration, I understand that. And there is obviously a palpable sense of fear that people have that the laws of the country are just being trashed. And a lot of people, especially around Kent, but also in different places around the country, they've had a lot of people moved in with them having nothing to say about that and not listened to and paid attention to. That is a real question, and we need a proper discussion about immigration policy. And a country has rights to defend its borders. Those are all reasonable things. But what I would dread to see happen is that we sabotage our own children out of some kind of frustration about people crossing the channel on boats, because there is an actual shortage of houses. It's not something anybody's made up. And it was going on when inward migration was at 50,000, not where it is today. Mm. And, the housing stock's about 26 million households. And you can assume a house is going to stand for about 100 years. That's, you know, the average. And if you don't replace them, all of our housing stock is going to collapse eventually. And we build less than 200,000 houses every year. So do the math. We're not building as many houses as we need to live in. And that's why your children cannot afford to buy or rent even, you know, because rents are dictated by the cost of a house anyway. And so when you look at your kids, there's no point in saying, oh, you know, they're still living at home because there's nowhere for them to go. I blame the migrants. I think it's like the stupid answer. You know, it's a kind of, it's not getting to the issue. It's that we need to build houses. And as the, you know, in the industry, they make the point, well, you know, a tremendous number of the people that work on building sites are migrants. So I think like making migrants into the reason why we haven't got houses is not really paying attention to what we have done when we screwed over our house building industry. On the second. Green Belt's fine, and as an idea, you know, that, you know, some places should be protected, but I don't think that's really what happened. You know, if you look at the map of the Green Belts, first off, why did they increase the land that was covered by Green Belt, and look at where they are. I mean, you know, they're precisely around the towns, And look at the proportions too. The amount of Britain which is actually built upon is less than 5%. You know, it's just get in a plane when you're flying over, have a look out the window. You know, when you get close to the airport, you're going to be able to see some buildings. But for a long time, every time you look out that window, all you're going to see is green. Britain is phenomenally green. It's an illusion that you get from living in a city, which obviously is where you want to live, is that when you look around, it's all concrete. Lo and behold, you live in a city. That's what your experience is telling you, that you can walk for months in the green countryside if you want to. The truth is, most of us, for most of the time, we don't want to. We, you know, we'd like to drop in and come out again. The green and pleasant land is not at risk from being concreted over.
And just finally on the questions of what people can do now, I mean, people have talked about all sorts of things like the end of history and a post-historical period. But, you know, you talk a lot, you've talked about, you know, what people can actually do, and sometimes they're complicated and all of that. But together, you've joined the cabinet, you're in the portfolio for housing. We're only just 2 years old, but we are having an impact. I mean, what would your message be to people who wanted to see some things change, who are frustrated about things, perhaps don't, you know, they're not, there aren't people who are articulating those things as much? How do you think that, you know, over the next period, we can have an impact in Britain and shape things? What's your take on that? What would you say to people?
As a member of the Together cabinet, I want to say the first thing is join together, and it's the thing that's given me most optimism for a long time. I was involved in lots of campaigns around housing and other stuff before, but you know, talking to my fellow Together campaigners has been the most exciting thing. And I honestly don't think that we have got a blueprint. You know, we're working on it, but you couldn't just pluck the idea about what the future should be like out of your head and kind of present it to the world. What I think is most optimistic about what we're doing and what you've been doing, all the people that have been campaigning over the different issues that we've been involved in are doing, is they're working out how to make the future. You know, they're working and they're reacting to practical problems that confront them. And some of them have got like big philosophical components, you know, like what do we do about lockdown and the environment and net zero. But a lot of them are quite straightforward issues like, you know, how do I get to school? And, you know, what happens if their energy bills get this high? And I think what's great about that is that I think for the first time for a long time, we've been able to just reflect on what the actual barriers to people's lives are and work out answers and not try and slot it into some boring preconceived notion, you know, that really belongs to the 20th or even the 19th century about, you know, is it left or is it right? Or, you know, we're thinking like, well, this is should be your first question, is like, what is it going to do for the people here in Britain? You know, well, what is this policy? Is this other people that are affected by it? Are they making this policy, or is it something dropped on their head by some planner who's got has maybe not got much idea? And that, to me, that's the thing that's most optimistic about Together in particular. But this time, you know, with the Brexit campaign, with the people protesting against the lockdown, with people talking about ULEZ and about low traffic neighborhoods, is that instead of, you know, this kind of boring stuff going on in Parliament and the main parties are trying to relate to what's going on, but what you see is a lot of people saying, well, right, is this right or not? You know, is this working or not? And are we in this or not? And that, to me, that's the spirit of Together. And that's what's making me very optimistic.
Great. So where can people find you, James? Just tell us your tag on Twitter. And your.
I'm like my name, I'm James Hartfield on Twitter. James, HEARTFIELD, with no gaps or spaces. And on the internet, I'm www.heartfield.org. And you find me sometimes writing for Spiked and around and about.
Brilliant. And for those of you that like this, also go to togetherdeclaration.org. You'll be able to find out more about the cabinet. Do also sign our petition, our new one, no to net zero.uk. I want to thank you, James, for a fascinating walk through history and talking about the current landscape. And I would encourage everyone to do as James says and join together. But we're going to be going to a break, and then I'm very pleased to say we're going to be joined by our next guest, who's been campaigning around a lot of these issues that James just talked about, ULEZ, low traffic neighbourhoods, 15-minute cities, and much more. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio, and come back to us just after the break.
You should hear what Greg Maybury is talking about.
What's your perspective on the work that he's done? I mean, and particularly not just as a parent and an activist, but as a musician as well, too. You're quite an accomplished musician.
Well, I think what Mark's able to do is through his research and stuff, is see how celebrities are used and how, you know, fashion and music and film and stuff is used, but in a very subtle way. So with the whole, you know, COVID jabs and all that stuff, it was very obvious. You know, you had Pink putting stuff on her Instagram, and you had people coming out on there social media and telling people to go and get jabbed or whatever. That was a kind of very obvious way of using celebrities, but he goes under the sort of dark underbelly of it, doesn't he, and exposes
very much
some,
so.
Of the, some of the, you know, subliminal messaging in the arts that people don't necessarily notice or realize, which is obviously the most dark way. It's the most dangerous form, really, because you don't necessarily see it coming. You know, it's kind of getting into kids' heads, you know, very subtly, which is what has been going on for a very long time.
The No Fly Zone with Greg Maybury on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
We've come so far as a nation. We are the envy of the world, and our future is limited only by our belief in each other.
Now we have a choice to make. Do we give in to guilt and division, or do we say no?
No to those who want to divide us.
I've decided to vote no because the voice will divide us.
No to those people who think all Indigenous Australians think the same.
We are not all the same, and there's a lot of us Aboriginal people that are voting no.
No to those who want to change the rule book of the country.
Why let them divide us? Because we are all Australians.
We are one mob.
Come on, Australia, let's stay united.
Vote no to the voice of division.
Authorised by Matthew Sheehan, Advance Australia Canada.
If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Alan Miller. And in this next part of the show, I'm very pleased to be joined by someone who's been campaigning ongoing. He was actually a nurse in his previous incarnation and involved in lots of work around that. But in more recent times, he's the director of the Alliance of British Drivers. And people will know about the Alliance of British Drivers because they are very concerned about issues about everything from road infrastructure to taxation, particularly around the internal combustion engine deadline and removing that. They're concerned about the issues and policies around net zero and anti-car policies and anti-driver policies, and a range of other issues around taxation, fuel duties, and mobility. I am very pleased to welcome Duncan White, who's the director there. How are you doing, Duncan?
Great. How are you, Alan?
Good, good. So firstly, thank you for joining us, because you've got an annual general meeting at Birmingham at the moment. So you've stepped out, and I'm very thankful for that. I suppose, like, we start off with, just give us a little overview about the kind of work that you're doing at the Alliance of British Drivers the question to open up with is there a war on drivers and cars? And if so, why do you think that is?
Yes, undoubtedly there is hostility towards car ownership and private car use. That is manifested in many measures that have been introduced slowly, incrementally, and almost seditiously, dare one say, over the years. And we look at the landscape at the present moment and see things like the London ULEZ, the Glasgow equivalent, the Oxford 15-minute city proposals, low traffic networks. And we see this as an onslaught on the right to freedom of association, the right of freedom of movement and travel. And in its practical application, it means that families, trade, business, commerce is being hemmed in, consistently hemmed in by measures that defy rational thought, defy logic, and we are campaigning against them. We see them as wholly unnecessary, wholly against the science, if you like, of what is happening. And when you hear people such as Sadiq Khan, the London mayor, quoting air quality issues, and councillors in Birmingham talking about safety and harm, there is no evidence to support any of these many and various claims. So we campaign vigorously against these measures. And I think in terms of bringing reality to bear on our politicians, both locally, nationally, and indeed internationally, it's a long haul, without a doubt. It's a long haul. But I think, you know, in terms of addressing the war on the motorists, the war on cars and private vehicle ownership, we're chipping away at it, and successfully chipping away at it, not least, of course, because of the help of the Together group.
So you're in Birmingham, and Birmingham, as we know, is the heart of where some of British motoring comes from, both in terms of motorcycles and cars. And we did an event together in Birmingham a while ago, and it's just remarkable to the extent to which the impact there. I mean, in Birmingham, we know that the Clean Air Zone in the Midlands has been imposed on lots of residents, and yet over 50,000 people refused to pay and have had their appeals upheld, which is fantastic news. So obviously, they're very unpopular, a lot of these measures. People have often not been consulted, or if they are consulted, like in Oxford, you mentioned the 15-minute cities, the bus gates, the low traffic neighbourhoods, when they are consulted, they're ignored. And people, you know, the local authorities go ahead anyway. I suppose it's a big question about democracy, isn't it, as well? It's about how people are listened to or not. Because I'm assuming that if there was a big debate and people all came to the conclusion, a majority said, well, actually, we thought about all of this, the costs and the benefits, the impacts to business. If they all then said, but we want it, then that would be different, wouldn't it? Because then you'd have a proper discussion, you know, as opposed to what we're seeing, which is an imposition, a series of measures that keep being imposed on us. Am I right in that? Or, you know, how do you see that?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely bound to rights in that. I think one of the big issues that we have at the present moment is that we have an anti-democratic political culture evolving. And we took a lot of time in terms of discussing the rational issues around the science, the technology, the mechanisms of motorised transport. And that rational discussion completely eludes the political classes because they have got themselves embedded in this ideological, cultural situation where we're dealing with beliefs of almost a religious fervour. They have this sort of religiosity around their ideas about how society should be run, how people, amount of freedom that people have, and that results in a huge network of interconnected control mechanisms. And when we talk about consultations in the democratic process, and for example, responding to the London ULEZ proposals, I mean, I wrote thousands and thousands of words in response to that, and demolished every single argument that was put forward. And even the consultation report that Sadiq Khan, the London mayor, commissioned from a Jacobs consultancy, a global consultancy of very considerable reputation, even the Jacobs report established that the benefits from the London ULEZ were zilch to zero, marginal at best, impossible to quantify, and at worst, negligible. So the rational argument, the logical argument, completely goes over their heads. They are embedded in this perverse and bizarre ideological framework. And particularly around Sadiq Khan, if you look at the map, he prides himself in being chair of the C40 Cities campaign, which is a global movement sponsored by various and somewhat nefarious organizations to bring about this curtailment of freedom, curtailment of the ownership and use of cars, curtailment of travel, flights, holidays, all that sort of stuff. And you'd look at the range of the C40 Cities movement, and they're actually up to about 90 plus now around the world. He prides himself in chairing that organization that is leading its way forward in terms of constraining the public, constraining the population.
What he would say, this is really important because some people know about C40 Cities, others don't, but what he would say and what C40 Cities would say was we're a group of mayors in different cities. It's not like this clandestine organization. It's all like in Britain, you've got a mayor, they're elected, it's part of devolution. You may disagree with that. You might think there shouldn't be devolution. We didn't need to have it, but we do have it. And then these mayors from different cities have got together to talk about what's going on. Obviously, Ken Livingstone initiated it. Then we saw others take it up. And then Mike Bloomberg plays a very leading role. And we know his views and how much he funds some of these, as a billionaire, funds some of these measures. So it is true that they have a particular outlook, but they'd say, you know, we're really about improving cities. We want to have smart cities. We want to have them so they're good places to live in. What's the tension there, do you think? Because he'd say, I'm voted in. I don't know what you're talking about, Duncan. I mean, I've got a majority, so here I am, and then I'm doing these things. So what's the problem with the C40 Cities bit and him chairing it? Just tell us specifically why you've got concerns about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's many layered. There's lots of elements to it. The first element is when you say that they're not surreptitious or underground. That is not true. Nobody stood for mayor on the basis that they are going to introduce and encourage a global cabal conspiring against the livelihoods, the industry, the well-being of its citizenry. And if they had got the guts to stand up and say, we are going to campaign about issues that are important to us, that means that we are going to curtail your freedoms, curtail your civil rights, curtail family life, curtail industry, trade, commerce, education, holidays even, then their majority in being elected would disappear through a hole in the floor. You know this, I know this. And when these issues have been put to the test and called out for what they are and shown for what the consequences and the impact of these measures that they want to introduce are, we see them for what they are. We see them for what they really are. They are nothing short of a Marxist tendency, and I'm not saying that they're all commies or reds under the beds or whatever, but it is part of the Marxist agenda of the creeping intrusion of the state into every aspect of daily life, of how people live, how people relate to each other. And yeah, okay, so we get accused of having tinfoil hats and being conspiracy theorists and all the rest of it. But when you see the conspiracy theory alive and well and kicking, and its manifestation is in the control mechanisms that are absolute in terms of the 15-minute city. Look at Oxford, how they've segmented Oxford. They want to segment Oxford up and control. You have to pay a fee to go between two sectors of the city. If you live in one sector and you want to go and visit your mum in a nursing home in another sector, the mechanism and the payments involved in doing that journey, in getting across the city to see your mum in a nursing home, are absolutely criminal in their intent in terms of breaching civil liberties and breaching...
Well, what they would say, yeah, you're right. Well, I think you're right. But what they would say is that you do get a certain amount of free passes and then you have to pay if you're a resident there. But the point surely is we never agreed to have to be surveyed and pay tolls or not at your discretion. That's something we all said, the majority of people in Oxford said they did not want. Now they're introducing next, each one's allegedly a trial and the next measure is based on the previous one. So now they're going to be charging people that are key workers, people that are medical staff and teachers that are coming into the hospital and schools that can't actually afford to live in Oxford. So they're all going to be charging the car parking zones and additional fees. Each one builds on the other and they keep saying, calling people names like Tim Fort Hat things rather than addressing the issues. That's why I think it's really important what you're doing in terms of your campaigning. Tell us a bit more about, so the Alliance of British Drivers, in terms of what your goals are and what would you like to see happen in this discussion around car driving and around people's mobility and freedom? Because some people say, well, Boris Johnson said this, and he was the guy who said, let's get on our bikes. And, you know, a bit like Norman Tebbit said that once, there was an outcry. When Boris said, let's all get on a bike, people seem to think it was with relish. But I like cycling, by the way. But what people will say, there are objectively many more cars than there ever were before. So, what is it? It's like, I remember when I moved to Nashville for a while and loads of people moved there. And then there was a lot more congestion. And that is true, right? It's just true. There's more congestion. There's more cars, more people. So the question is, can that be improved with better roads, more roads, better infrastructure, tunnels? Or like, how do you see all of that? That's an urban planning question. It's a question of logistics, sort of transport, all of those sorts of things. And I should just say that whilst these conversations go on, it's not like they say, well, here's the brilliant public transportation for everyone. These are all the other services we provide in these areas. They don't do that. They just say, here's the cameras and there's the fines. And by the way, this is now 15-minute city or whatever. So it's not like they're suddenly saying we're improving infrastructure. But from the point of view of the question, well, there are more cars. I remember, just not to keep going on about this, but my granddad was one of the first people who had cars in Britain, right? And it was like 1956, 50s. I remember looking at the roads along the embankment and all of that on those old 16mm cine camera footage they've got, and they played it to the family, and there were like just a few cars, right? And we obviously experience something different now. It looks more like the old New York movies from the 70s and 80s. That's what many cities look like now. How do you look at that? How do you think about things being worked out and resolved from that point of view? Do you, and what does it mean, and how do you engage with that type of thing?
Yeah, I mean, certainly as an organisation, we are very keen to promote an integrated transport regime. But we have fragmentation. We have bits and pieces being done out of synchronisation with the needs and transport requirements of the population at large. And that's typified by things like cycle lanes, bus lanes, that unilaterally and arbitrarily take up road space for a diminished part of the population, diminished part of the transport network, at the expense of the greater need. Now, we are absolutely, absolutely keen to promote an integrated transport network where there is, and you can look around the world and see examples, and people always talk of cycles in Holland and trams in Singapore and one thing another. If we had a proper coordinated, synchronized, integrated transport system nationally where private car ownership was used in a measured, logical way rather than having to use it because it's the only way you can get to work or take the kids to school or go shopping or whatever, then we would be very happy bunnies, make no mistake about it. But whilst we see that there is such disaggregation, disconnection, disintegration of the transport network, where you cannot get to various places. I mean, for example, our conference that you mentioned earlier when you introduced me, people cannot get to this place without driving. There's no public transport. We're outside of Birmingham. We're not in the middle or anything like that. You cannot get there without driving. There's no public transport. There's no buses, no trams, no trains. You have to drive. Now, if we had a proper integrated system, then we would be very happy bunnies. But I think the constant erosion of the facilities to free up society, free up families, free up industry, commerce and trade to travel in an unrestricted and sensible way, rational way, is just not happening. And you know, you look at things like this HS2 debacle over the last few days. You know, the great long-term view of connecting London with Manchester, Leeds, and further. You know, that's come to naught, and that has now been cancelled. That's an absolute symptom of the inability of the political class to see the big picture, to get it. Now, we're also building new towns all over the place. And there was a story in the national press a couple of weeks ago of a massive housing estate built, no shops, no bus routes, no schools, no connection. The thousands of people in that new town have no choice but to drive their own personal private vehicle. Now, you know, it doesn't take a huge amount of brain space to work out that you're going to have to connect transport systems together to diminish the use of the car. And the reason there are 37 million car users who use them daily, and we're running up billions of miles a year in car usage, is because that is the only viable way of doing it.
It's also quite a lot of fun. And I remember it's like a rites of passage, actually, when you're going to become 17. It's like one of those great things that you do. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. I'm here with Duncan White. Join us just after this break. Come back to us.
Where are the 1970s Volvo driving save the world liberals when you need them? Well, they've been replaced by Donald Trump.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Environmentalists have been largely silent as whale slaughter continues along America's East Coast with the construction of offshore windmills. But while environmentalists are silent, former President Donald Trump is very vocal and nails the issue.
Their windmills are causing whales to die in numbers never seen before. Nobody does anything about that. They're washing up ashore. I saw it this weekend. Three of them came up. You wouldn't see it once a year. Now they're coming up on a weekly basis. The windmills are driving them crazy.
Donald Trump, now more green than the green movement. It's time to put an end to the folly of offshore wind. Even federal scientists are admitting the harm caused by these windmills. And the even more absurd part is wind produces very little energy. It requires rare earth mining, fossil fuel transportation, reliance on China, oil, difficulty recycling, and once again, they produce very little energy. Unreliable, intermittent whale killing. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
The Black Lives Matter Network, or BLM Network, founded by the three black female activists who created the hashtag Black Lives Matter hashtag, can be differentiated from the BLM movement. A more amorphous collection of racial justice groups, the BLM Network is a structured organization that has 34 chapters. Gaza described the network as an online platform that existed to provide activists with a shared set of principles and goals. Local Black Lives Matter chapters are asked to commit to the organization's list of guiding principles, but operate without a central structure or hierarchy. Gaza has commented that the network was not interested in policing who is and who is not part of the movement. The Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation, one of the main organizations coordinating organizing and mobilization efforts across the Black Lives Matter network, reportedly raised up to $90 million in 2020. Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation, Inc. is a global organization in the US, UK, and Canada, whose stated mission is to eradicate white supremacy and build local power to intervene on violence on black communities by the state and vigilantes. The Black Lives Matter movement founders have connections to large radical left organizations. The connection to the left has made the BLM movement rich and influential. Influence Watch estimates that groups associated with the BLM movement have taken in $133 million since 2013. Organizations associated with liberal billionaire George Soros are said to have provided at least $33 million to various BLM movement groups since 2016. In 2015, the fundraising club Democracy Alliance, led by liberal donors like George Soros and Taco Bell heir Rob McKay, recommended its donors to increase contributions to endorsed groups that have supported the Black Lives Matter movement.
You're listening to The Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back. Duncan was just talking about the lack of proper grown-up rational planning and thinking about how we organise our urban areas and our rural areas. I really agree with you, Duncan. I think that you're one of the things that's really missing is what we've tried to, we want to plug this gap a little bit with the Together Cabinet, but an insistence on a robust approach, a dynamic approach to infrastructure, transportation, travel, how we organise things. I mean, you know, you think about the past, when you think about the Victorians and tunnelling to the future, think about tunnels and bridges and roads. People had a very kind of robust approach towards it. Often, you know, and you have to look at documentaries, people like George Burns talking about the Brooklyn Bridge, right? People lost their lives and health and safety wasn't at the forefront. So there were problems with things, but there was a sense of purpose and what could be done. And now when we try and even think about infrastructure projects or do things, although, by the way, I love the Elizabeth line, but I think that's an exception rather than the rule at the moment, that we are not, it's not happening. And that surely has got to be something that is at the heart of any sensible approach, I'd say, for the next 100 years. Like, where does Britain want to be? Are we going to have a kind of Festival of Britain, a kind of World's Fair approach, where we think we get the best and the brightest from around the world? I mean, they're doing it in Doha, they do it in Dubai, they're doing it in other places, right? Mumbai, they're attracting people because Singapore, they attract people because they invest, they're serious about a whole range of things like architecture, transportation, infrastructure, education, development. They don't sneer at those terms, right? They know that they're the kind of things that attract people and transform the landscape and build for the future. We've lost some of that, haven't we, I think? What do you reckon?
Presentation that goes on between local authorities who have various planning authority rights and central government is frankly astonishing. And the idea that you would have all these disparate groups, local authorities, councils, town, parish councils, whatever, all doing their own bit, all doing their own thing, in a way that does not knit together and pull together the national requirements. And that lack of forethought is built into our political system. And we bump into it continuously on a forever basis. One council is doing X, another regional authority is doing Z, and national government wants to do something else completely. So we've lost that ability. Politically, we seem to have lost that ability to think big, to think broader than the next election, to think broader than the local parish boundary or the local council boundary. And I think until we overcome that, until we recognise the fact that we need to harness our resources and our skills in a far more defined and focused way, we are forever going to be doing bit pieces, little pieces.
Well, what people will say to you, what people might say is that, but that's local democracy in a national democratic situation. My question to you would be, Duncan, is that, why would there be a mismatch? Why would a local or regional planning outlet not correspond to a national one that was going to be creating jobs, infrastructure, development? Is it just that people are just like, well, you said that, so we're going to say this? Or is it that there's a genuine disdain for the idea of a bit more ambitious planning, execution of bigger goals there? Is it a mixture of both? How do you see it?
Yeah, that is, as the politician would say, an interesting question. And I think you have different political agendas at different levels. And to try and get local authorities to coordinate with each other, let alone in a national scheme, has proved impossible. So, we've built motorways the length and breadth of the country on a national basis. And you need that sort of authority, that sort of national agenda, to bring together all the elements of an integrated transport system. Now, I mean, you can look at different local authorities and you can see that they are working against a national agenda, a nationalised priority system. And you can see that the government are struggling to implement overall control and methods of delivering an integrated transport system. And, you know, half-hearted attempts like HS2 that should have connected, simply should have connected with HS1, and made, you know, no sense to disconnect it from that. Yet it did, and it's failed. And that is the story we see across the board of repetitive failure in terms of bringing stuff together. And to come back to your question, there is undoubtedly competitive nature within local authorities, between local authorities and national government. And it's this hideous Tory Labour divide. And you see it manifesting all over the place. And I think, you know, if we're ever going to get out of this quagmire in so many ways, and your previous speaker was talking about the quagmire of housing, well, it's the same with transport. We've got to move in terms of the national agenda, the national approach, where, you know, sensible, rational things can be brought to pass. We just don't do it. So I think that competitive element is working against the national benefit almost. So
I think you're right on that. I mean, I think one thing that I want to cite one example of something that I think has been really good, which is it's been a long time in the coming, because obviously people like Michael Heseltine talked about the gateway to London and the Thames estuary and East London and the underdeveloped nature of it. But historically, since the Blitz and all that, we all know that much of East London was not utilised. Then we had Canary Wharf. But Newham, because of the Olympics a lot, and then also to do with the connection of infrastructure to the King's Cross and to the Eurotunnel, has made Stratford and Newham really important. And the combination of the Olympics and what went on with that and the development and regeneration, we should remember that the Olympics, I would say that's a brilliant example of what we're talking about that could be done positively, where everybody for a moment came out. We were on our streets, we were out together, we had a sense of national purpose up where we were all like that, encouraged around it. You know, it was, I don't remember scenes like that since really the Jubilee, the Silver Jubilee. Like, I remember that when I was a kid, it was like in the 70s and everyone was out street park. But it was a really brilliant, I'm sure there might have been a couple of others, but it was a real moment where everyone took sort of sense, yeah, we're all neighbours and colleagues and friends, and they were very exciting, enthusiastic. And I know many people interpreted things in different ways about it and they projected their own ideas onto it. But it was a really good example of arranged things. And Newham, if you think about it, they've done huge hundreds and hundreds of acres of development of housing, universities, art centres, fashion design studios. Obviously, you've got the Queen Elizabeth, you've got the whole, all of the sports centres, and all of the, it's really remarkable because it's landscaped and you've got fast train communications and you can get anywhere across London now, and people have come to move there and live there, and so that's exciting. And then you think, well, I've been to Beijing and other places in the past. You see, you think got things like that going on all the time, everywhere, right? You've got all sorts of development all the time. And I think you're right. The question is, what's our ambition level and what's our sense of purpose and planning? I think that together, that's also what we're very keen about doing, saying that the public should be at the heart of these things. The work you're doing, you know, the drivers and everything, there's so many of us, tens of millions of people who rely on cars, and actually, frankly, just we shouldn't have to legitimize why we want them. And we're like, you know, we've got them and we should be able to use them. But also, how do we, whose priorities should we be putting at the forefront? And, you know, surely it should be the public, it should be our voices, our concerns, and politicians, both nationally and locally, whatever color they are politically, right? They should put the public's interest. What does the public need? How do we, as citizens, what's going to be the best for us? We need to get that a little bit more on the front foot. That should be what the criteria is. Absolutely.
And I think it goes back to how do we create a situation where the national priorities come to the surface? Now, for example, in terms of sort of the national future over the next, what, 10, 15, 20 years, you know, we have a whole range of issues that need to be sorted out in terms of food security, immigration, energy security, and of course, part and parcel of that is a national transportation security in terms of shipments, imports, exports, and all that sort of all those discussions. And I think until we create a political system where we have an ability to frame a national long-term strategy for developing the country, for stabilizing food security, stabilizing the population, immigration, housing, transport, water supplies, all these sorts of things, particularly energy at the moment, then I think we are going to go on forevermore in the traditional British way of fudging. And, you know, we as a nation, we fudge. And it's a terrible indictment. And you look at the NHS, you know, it's just, where, which is my professional background, you know, healthcare. Terrible catalogue of half measures, fudging, and inability to frame a way forward that gives us a national strategy, a national stabilising influence politically. So in answer to your question, you know, this is where you become a bit of a sort of revolutionary, because until we face up to the fact, the many facts, that we're just not getting things right, we're going to go on mucking about like this. So I think, you know, the answer to your question is very unsavoury.
But, you know, on the flip side of all of this is that we have seen in the last year and in the last 6 months, a real pushback by many citizens in Britain, right? We've seen pushbacks all around the country around low traffic neighbourhoods. We've seen them come out in Newcastle. We've seen them come out in Warrington. We've seen them come out in Tower Hamlets, all for different reasons. We've seen a pushback around ULEZ, ultra low emission zone and clean air zones. And even though it's gone forward, they're still contested highly. And Uxbridge, we know, was impacted by it as a by-election. And we know now the Conservatives and Labour are both talking about net zero, not just using it as a platitude. The GMB, the union, has said this will damage and impact people. So it is having an impact, right, when citizens and others get involved. You must be quite pleased about that. Do you think there's more that can be done? How would you see that?
Yeah. I mean, when you say I'm pleased that's happening, well, yes, we are pleased, but we are not pleased because it shouldn't have to happen. It should not be necessary for the public at large to rise up and create situations like we have the Blade Runners who are breaking the law, who are going around cannibalising, snipping, demolishing ULEZ cameras. The need for the citizenry to have to rise up like this is an absolute anathema. It is a shameful reflection on the way the politics of this country has gone over the last few years. And the last thing we want is to have uprisings, for want of a better word. I mean, I was at the Oxford meeting with Not Our Future, where we distributed leaflets all around town, waking the Oxford population up to the seriousness of what the local council had in line for them in terms of segmenting the city, 15-minute city and all the rest of it. We should not have to do this. Part of the democratic process should be that these sorts of measures are openly discussed, openly voted on. And if that means we have to have Brexit-type referendums on a whole load of stuff, then, yeah, that's where we've got to go. The last thing we want to see is the need for the public to have to rise up against this. It just absolutely should not happen. So when we see it happening, yes, of course, we support anti-ULEZ moves, anti-LTN, anti-Birmingham CAS moves. Yes, of course, we support that. But it's the symptom of the disease that is being addressed here. It's not the disease itself. And if we start looking at the disease, and we are certainly campaigning against net zero as a political philosophy, as an operational implementation of the wrong science. They've just got it wrong. You know, and you do not need to be a rocket scientist or a atmospheric chemist or a paleontologist or whatever to read the science behind net zero and realise it's bonkers, it's wrong. And that is.
And on that note, that's why, because we're coming to the end of the show, and people can see the Alliance of British Drivers. You'll be able to look at them there on obviously online. You can go to that. It's abd.org.uk. Duncan, I want to thank you for coming on to the show. We at Together have actually got a notonetzero.uk site petition you can go to. Come visit us at togetherdeclaration.org. We're going to be working with Duncan and many other people challenging these measures up and down the country. This is the way forward in Britain. Stay free. Keep committed to our liberties, privacy, autonomy. Let's do it together at Together Dec. Come see us. I'm at Alan Vibe. I'll see you next week for a show. Thanks so much. Stay free. This is TNT Radio.